the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. There's a great new book on my baseball bookshelf, and it is Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend, by James S. Hirsch. It's a long book, long like a doubleheader on a warm Saturday afternoon in the Polo Grounds. James S. Hirsch is a former reporter for the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, and he's the author of four nonfiction books, including the New York Times bestseller Hurricane, The Miraculous Journey of Reuben Carter. James S. Hirsch, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first of all, you compare Willie Mays, baseball player, to the most important men in American history. How come?
Well, actually, it was Barack Obama who compared Willie to John Kennedy and Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King during Obama's run for the presidency. And I think the reason Obama did that is because Willie does occupy a special place, not just in our sports history, but really in our cultural history. Willie played baseball in the major leagues for 22 years, and he played it with so much skill and joy and passion. He touched the hearts of so many Americans, and they remembered how he played, and they've now passed those stories along to their children and their grandchildren. So, you know, Willie truly is an American icon, an American legend, and I think that's why he is given that place in our history with those other famous men.
Well, set the scene for us, if you would. Now, why did baseball need Mays in 1951, as you say in your book? How did Mays change the game?
Well, he changed the game on one level by really redefining the game of baseball. At the time, there were, broadly speaking, two categories of players. You had the classic home run hitter, the prototype of which was Babe Ruth, and then you had the classic high-speed, high-average, stolen base guy. The prototype for that was Ty Cobb. Willie was able to lead the league in both home runs and stolen bases and batting average, as well as play center field, as well, if not better, than anyone before or since. There were other complete players in the game, men like DiMaggio and Williams and Musial, but Willie was the first true five-tool player. That phrase didn't even exist until Willie came along. So in that sense, he was a completely new archetype. And he came along at the right time for Major League Baseball because in 1951, the game was considered to be kind of dull. A lot of station-to-station baseball. Players like Jackie Robinson, who came in 1947, he added some excitement to the game and some of the other black players who followed. But the game was considered one-dimensional at the time. Willie came in and just added a second and third dimension that was very much appreciated at the time. It was like he was like a jolt of adrenaline to a game that definitely needed it at that time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that style that he brought to the game. In the Negro Leagues, that was sort of the style of play. I know that Mays didn't spend that long in the Negro Leagues, but he did play with them. And did he inherit that sort of stolen base, scratching out runs, but also hitting big?
Absolutely. Willie played 3 years for the Birmingham Black Barons, and they were incredibly important years in developing Willie as a player. For one thing, in the Negro Leagues, those teams had fairly short rosters. You know, only 16, 17, 18 men on a team. So if you played on that team, on those teams, you had to be a versatile player. You had to be able to do all things, because the manager was limited in substitution. So when we talk about Willie being a great complete player, he developed those skills in part by playing in the Negro Leagues. Moreover, in the Negro Leagues, the focus was on entertaining the fans. Baseball was woven into the fabric of those communities. You would go to church on Sunday morning. The pastor would then say, "Okay, and now it's time to go to the ball field." And everyone would go to the ball field, and it was you were to go there to watch the game, but there were also parades and bands and jugglers and clowns, and it was a festival. And the players talked about how, well, our job was to win, certainly, but we also wanted to give the fans something to talk about when they left the field. And so how do we make the game entertaining? So they had all kinds of games that they would play to do that. And Willie imported that style with him when he joined the New York Giants in 1951. Most famously, you know, the basket catch was something he did that just added some drama and flair. But, you know, he also had the thing where the hat would go flying off his head when he rounded the bases. He played the game with a level of excitement and bravado that was all designed to keep the fans entertained, and he very much learned that playing in the Negro Leagues.
And when he came to New York, his first manager was Leo DeRocher, and DeRocher had a lot to do with really honing his skills as a major league player.
Absolutely, and DeRocher did more than that. He was really the father figure who recognized that Willie Mays, at age 20 when he joined the Giants, was someone who needed unconditional love and support. Willie was petrified when he got to the Giants. He didn't know if he really belonged because he was so young. There he was in New York City. He had spent his whole life rather sheltered in Alabama. Now he gets there. He starts off in a terrible slump. He goes 1-for-26, and DeRocher famously says to him, you know, as long as I'm the manager, you're my center fielder. At the time, Willie thought that he probably belonged back in the minor leagues. He may even belong back in the Negro Leagues. And so DeRocher gave him that confidence, that reassurance that he did indeed belong in the major leagues. They developed a very close relationship. And maybe DeRocher's greatest contribution to Major League Baseball wasn't just all the games he won as manager, but was making sure that Willie had the faith that he needed in himself. Willie goes on to win the Rookie of the Year award in 1951, and from there he's on his way.
We're talking with James S. Hirsch, if you're just joining us, and his fabulous new book is called Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. And it's about Willie Mays, by the way. And it's a great book. Your book is mostly about baseball, but being an American story, it's also about race. And Mays was born in Alabama during the time of segregation, whereas you report in your book a white boy and a black boy could not play checkers together. But the most shocking racism, I think, occurs when Mays and the Giants come to San Francisco in 1958.
That's right. The Giants moved to San Francisco in that year, and San Francisco takes great pride as being a very sophisticated and cosmopolitan and tolerant city. Willie and his wife go there in early 1958, and they try to buy a home in a white neighborhood, and their bid to buy the home is rejected by the builder because he's fearful if he allows a black person to buy this home, he will not be able to get other jobs to build other homes, or he won't be able to sell existing homes. And so Willie's efforts to buy the house is turned down. The city tries to figure out a way to solve the problem, the mayor and others in the city, before it becomes known publicly, because everyone knows this will be a huge embarrassment to San Francisco's image of itself. But the story does leak out. It's on the front pages, not just in San Francisco, but all across California, all across the country. It makes it on TV, on the radio, and it becomes a real slap in the face to San Francisco, because at the time, you know, we're kind of in the beginning of the civil rights movement. The belief was that it was only in the Deep South where blacks couldn't live where they wanted to live or couldn't buy the homes that they wanted to buy. Now the veil is lifted, and in fact these types of practices occur across the country, even in our most liberal, sophisticated city in the country. Ultimately, the issue is resolved, and Willie is allowed to buy that home, and he and his wife do move in there and live there for a couple of years. Willie never complained about the experience publicly because that just wasn't his style. In fact, he would defend the builder. He would say that, well, you know, the builder has to make a living also. But it was an important moment in Willie's career because people tended to forget that he was victimized by racism because Willie always kept those kinds of experiences to himself. And because this was such a public event, it reminded Americans that Willie was just like every other black person in the country. He, too, experienced racism.
Well, the other black players in the league, and in 1951, I suppose there weren't quite as many as there were in subsequent years when Willie was playing. But, you know, Frank Robinson, Jackie Robinson, those players have a kind of a reputation of being angry. Frank Robinson, in his autobiography, said, never make friends with a player because if you ever get traded, you might have to spike him as you're sliding in a second bench. But Willie Mays didn't have that same attitude at all. He thought of players as family and so forth.
Baseball was always his family, not just his teammates and his coaches and the owner, but the umpires, the opposing players, the opposing managers, the owners of the other teams. It was a lesson that really, it goes back to playing in the Negro Leagues, where the players would board these buses and drive throughout the night, throughout the South, throughout the country, just one traveling clan. That was his family. And when he joined the Giants and played in the major leagues, that was how he saw his teammates then, and that was how he saw all of Major League Baseball. And it's interesting to hear Willie talk now about how the game has changed, and that Willie played before free agency was allowed, and basically, you know, when a team signed you, you were restricted to that team for the duration of your career, unless that team traded you. In many ways, of course, this was very unfair to the players because they were not allowed to go and sell themselves on the free market to the highest bidder, as players are now. But in that era, there was a greater sense of the team as being kind of a family, and the owners at that time served that role as a kind of a patriarch, where they would look after players more. Now, if the player was no longer productive, the owner would get rid of the player. So that was always the case. But compared to the way the game is now, where the players are much less connected to their cities and to their teams. Now you just go to the highest bidder. Back in Willie's day, there was a much closer connection, and as Willie saw it, a greater sense of family, and he thinks some of that is now missing.
Well, but he was also accused, just to get back to the race issue for a little bit, of being an Uncle Tom, because he wasn't so angry at least upfront about his feelings about racial discrimination. Did he not have those feelings, or, you know?
Yeah, no, that's true. Willie was accused principally by Jackie Robinson as being an Uncle Tom or a do-nothing Negro, and those criticisms hurt Willie, coming from Jackie Robinson, because Jackie was one of Willie's heroes. But remember, Willie was born and raised in the Deep South, in Alabama in the 1930s and 40s, and he was taught at a very young age, if you as a black person want to make it in the white world, you have to keep your mouth shut. You have to keep your head down. You cannot allow your adversaries any opportunity to prevent you from being successful. And coming from Alabama at that time, that was good advice, because blacks were routinely arrested, incarcerated, had their homes bombed, killed in some instances, if they got out of line. So that was good advice for a young black person to receive. And as Willie says, you know, I was programmed to be that way. And the reality was that Willie could never be deprogrammed. To this day, he believes that if he were to say the wrong thing, or something that might be controversial, he would lose all the goodwill that he had built up. You know, Willie always believed that his celebrity was perishable, that he would lose all of that if he somehow got involved in something controversial. But Willie also, however, believed that he was able to make a contribution to the civil rights movement just by being Willie Mays, by how he comported himself on and off the field. Willie never smoked, he never drank, he never got involved in any scandals, he got his rest, he was never involved in, you know, barroom fights like Mantle and the other players of that era. And of course, he played the game at a level that no one else played it, not just with great skill, but also preparation and intelligence. And in doing research for the book, you know, I interviewed others of that era to get their feedback on what contributions Willie made beyond baseball. And I spoke to Bill Clinton, and Clinton talks about growing up in Arkansas in the 1950s. He's surrounded by segregationists who would fight tooth and nail to preserve Jim Crow during the week, but then on Saturday they would stay home and watch Willie Mays on Game of the Week. And, you know, Clinton says Willie made a mockery of all forms of bigotry. And even on a subconscious level, Willie made a huge contribution to how white people viewed black people. There was a sports writer in the 1960s in San Francisco who said that he came to understand Willie's contributions to America when he was out at a Little League game in Texas, and there was a center fielder out there, a kid who was the grandson of a Ku Klux Klansman, and he's out there yelling, look at me, I'm Willie Mays. And finally, Willie himself understood these contributions. He said, speaking of the bigots, he said, I changed the hatred to laughter.
It, when Mays had only just begun playing in the major leagues, he was drafted into the Army, and although he claimed extreme hardship because he was the sole provider for his siblings and his mother, they drafted him anyway. Do you think that some of that was racially motivated?
No. The Army drafted Willie because they wanted to show that they were not going to play favorites to athletes or to celebrities, and so they drafted other baseball players as well, because the military had been accused in the past of giving breaks to to these professional athletes. So they rejected Willie's claims, which were legitimate, for a hardship case, and they did draft Willie. But the great irony of it was that once they drafted Willie, they used him as a baseball player, because in the Army, all the Army forts and had baseball teams, and the commander at Fort Eustis, where Willie was stationed, not only wanted to make sure that Willie was playing on his team, but he would bet on the games against other Army teams. And so essentially what Willie did in the Army was he played baseball. And so the whole thing was just this one great farce, because they wanted to draft Willie to show that they weren't going to give any special privileges to a baseball player. But once Willie got into the Army, they did nothing but give him special privileges.
Well, for those of us who live in the Bay Area and are Giants fans, one of the most remarkable things about the career of Willie Mays is that he played in Candlestick Park, which in your book you unabashedly say it's the worst stadium ever built.
yes, and you know, one of the great parts of doing the research for the book was researching Candlestick Park and writing about, you know, what a horrible, wind-tormented place that was, and how difficult it was, for the fans to sit through those games, and more importantly for the players. But one gains a lot more appreciation for what Willie accomplished, because it was such a difficult ballpark to play in, particularly for a right-handed power hitter, because the wind went left to right, and Willie had to adjust his swing to try to hit home runs, to hit the ball to right field in order to get it over the fence. And just learning how to play the winds and to play the game at such a high level. So many of the players who came to Candlestick left it saying, as Ozzie Smith said, "I never knew how great Willie Mays was until I came to Candlestick Park."
We're speaking with James S. Hirsch, and his book is called Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend, authorized by Willie Mays. So, you know, a lot of people think if it's authorized, then maybe it's, you know, going to be a whitewash. No pun intended. But that doesn't appear to be the case. Did he give you free rein to tell his story?
Yes. Willie had no editorial control over the manuscript. And however, he did read the manuscript before it was published to confirm facts, and if there were any factual errors, to correct them, or if he thought I got anything wrong or any of my interpretations were wrong. But in fact, Willie did not ask me to change anything in what is a lengthy book, except for one very minor detail that's not even worth mentioning. And the book is not a Valentine to Willie Mays. I talk about the problems he had with money, the problems he had with friends, he had a very difficult first marriage, and which ended in a painful divorce. I talk about the criticism that he received from the press over the years. And so it is a three-dimensional portrait of Willie, which I think is one of the reasons, why the book has been well received. But what's interesting about Willie is that, when I first met him and asked if he would cooperate with this, and by his cooperation, what that meant was that he would speak with me for as long as I needed to, and just as importantly, open up the door to his friends, teammates, family, who would also speak with me, and many of whom had never been interviewed about Willie Mays. He agreed to all that, knowing that I was going to write what I find, knowing that I wasn't going to just write a Valentine to him, because in fact Willie is very proud of the life that he's lived. He's very mindful of the trajectory of his life. That he was born a Depression era black kid in the Deep South, where blacks were denied the most basic civil rights. He reached the pinnacle of the American sports world at age 23, and now he's an American icon who can fly on Air Force One with the President of the United States. As Willie said to me, "I could not have dreamt the life that I've lived." So at the end of the day, I think Willie, while he is a very private individual, he wanted a complete outsider like myself to come in and to evaluate that life and to validate it, because Willie knows that he's lived a good life, and now it's been recorded, and now that legacy, both on and off the field, is there for all to read.
Well, follow up a little bit on the criticism that the San Francisco Willie Mays encountered with the press. He hadn't had that much problem in New York, but when he got here to California, the press was all over him.
Right. Well, there are several different issues going on when Willie came west. Number one, the Giants hyped Willie to no end as a way to sell tickets. Willie was the headliner in baseball's expansion to California. Well, San Francisco was a very proud baseball town. It had the San Francisco Seals of the Pacific Coast League for many years. And San Francisco fans and the media, didn't necessarily want this New Yorker coming in. And the Giants compounded the problem by comparing Willie to Joe DiMaggio and saying Willie was actually better than Joe DiMaggio, who, of course, was born and raised in San Francisco and was a local idol. And no one could compare to Joe DiMaggio. So the fans and the media resented that. And the town wanted its own heroes, players whom they discovered. And in 1958, Orlando Cepeda is a rookie, and he has a great year. He's very charismatic, very popular, and he's their guy. And then Cepeda is followed by McCovey, and then the Alou brothers, and then Marichal. So they've got their own group of legitimate San Francisco Giants. They don't have to embrace this warmed-over New York Giant, who was Willie Mays. And so the fans booed Willie in those first few years. And any number of the sports writers and columnists ripped Willie in the press. And that had never happened to Willie before. And Willie's very thin-skinned. He's very sensitive. And that hurt him. And it took Willie a good 5 years to really feel as if he won over the town. And it was really in 1962 when the Giants won the pennant, and Willie had a great year and played extremely well down the stretch and got big hits to get them to the World Series. That was when I think the city really embraced Willie and could see Willie as their own.
Well, you've obviously spent a lot of time with Willie Mays, and you say in your book, and I'm paraphrasing, I guess, but you say that his best qualities had nothing to do with baseball. What did you mean by that?
Willie is extremely generous with friends, generous to a fault, and also with kids. And he does these things for his friends and for kids, all out of the media spotlight. Willie has never had a publicist in his whole life. He has no corporate sponsors. He has no agents. He has no lawyers who are out there promoting him. But so this other side of Willie that no one is a side that no one knows about, but I was able to get close to and write about. So, you know, things with friends, you know, if a friend of his passed away, he goes to the funeral and he gives the widow an envelope with $5,000 in cash. No one knows about it, but I found about it 'cause people told me of it. But those are the kinds of things that Willie does. You know, if someone is in need, they need money, Willie is there for them. And then his long rapport with children, which really dates back to when he was a rookie with the New York Giants, and, you know, there were these famous photographs and film footage of Willie playing stickball in the streets of Harlem with kids. Willie has always had this special affection and kindness for kids, because he trusts them. He knows that kids will not betray him. He talks about how when he was a ball player, when he was going well, he'd get a ton of letters from all kinds of people. But then when he would go into a slump, the adults would stop writing him, but the kids would keep writing him. They always stayed with him. And so I write about how Willie would, you know, go to the hospitals. He'd go to, I've got this great scene in the book of Willie going to a school of blind children in Pittsburgh. The children wanted to quote, see Willie Mays. And so Willie goes there and gives this very heartwarming talk to these children. And at the end of the talk, the kids come up to Willie and they start touching his arms and his face because they can't really see him, but they know how special he is. And to this day, Willie goes to the hospitals out in California, to the pediatric ward in Stanford, and he signs the baseballs for the kids. And actually, there's a great photograph in the book of this boy, tubes coming out of him, and Willie there signing the ball for him and talking to him. And so that's a side of Willie that no one knows about except his friends. And it's a side that I feel very pleased and honored to be able to reveal to Willie, because too often he comes off in the general public as this kind of gruff, remote man. And in fact, the reality is much more complicated than that.
Well, Willie Mays had a career to be proud of, and this book is something that you should be very proud of. And the book is called Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend, and the author is James S. Hirsch. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back again next week for another great show. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And I want to thank James S. Hirsch, author of Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.